Namo Buddhaya. Jai Bhim.
Thank you very much, Padmavajra. I'm very restrained today. So I hear from Padmavajra that you like hearing stories about Bhante. So I'm going to make up a few. I'm not. Today my theme is really about the bodhicitta as a dynamic force in those who connect with it. And I want to start by illustrating that a little bit from Bhante's life, and then, my experience of Bhante, and then a little bit about his life and the background too. He was taking the bodhisattva vow. So about 8 years ago, that must have been about 2010, I haven't worked it out precisely, I went to see Bhante, and it was at the time when he'd been having, maybe it was a bit earlier than 2010, anyway, sometime 2008, 9, 10. He'd been having a lot of difficulty sleeping. We know now that it's probably to do with the medication he was being given. He's an extremely sensitive system. I've seen that a number of times over the years I've known him. You know, an aspirin to me is, I don't even notice it. He notices it for days. But anyway, he'd not been able to sleep, much for days, weeks, months, even a year or more. And a lack of sleep, and anybody who suffers from sleep deprivation, which I don't, knows how hellish it can be, because sleep is nature's balm, ravels, what is it, knits up the unraveled sleeve of care, etc. And well, apparently the Stasi, the East German secret police, despised their forebears, the Gestapo, because they used, you know, crude forms like thumbscrews and things like that, whereas the Stasi just used to keep people awake. And after a few days, they'll tell you anything. Anyway, all that's to illustrate the fact that Bhante had a really very unpleasant experience. And when I went to see him, he'd sort of come out of it, but they got the medication right. And he told me it had been a really hellish period. He talked about it as annus horribilis. The Queen echoed him the next year in her, in her speech. But he said that his experience now was of the world as being, he said, disgusting. He found conditioned existence disgusting. He didn't mean in a sort of a merely, you know, like seeing something that turns your stomach. It was aesthetically disgusting, I think you could say. Spiritually disgusting, repellent. And in my own mind, I thought that perhaps what he was talking about was Nibbida or Nirveda in the spiral path. You remember after Yathabhuta Jnana Darshana arises Nirveda or Nibbida. A feeling of revulsion, of withdrawal, of you don't want the conditioned. It holds no attraction for you. Indeed, that you feel a sort of repulsion to it, I suppose, because there's still some process of withdrawing from it. Anyway, he said that was his experience, and he said that what he really felt like was just a long sort of rest. He felt like just dying and nothing, a blank, a rest. And he told me all this, so my hair standing on end, because, you know, you don't usually get such remarkable people opening up their inner experience, and whilst they're doing it, you know that your own understanding is not quite equal to what you're being told. Mm. I felt quite humbled by it. Mm. Then he said, well, yes, he just didn't feel like coming back. And it's all sort of playing out in front of me, just watching, as he's saying, what his experience was. He didn't feel like coming back into existence. And he said, I do believe in rebirth. I'm sure I will be reborn, but I don't feel like doing it, like being reborn. And then he said an extraordinary sort of reflective tone, but then there is the Bodhisattva vow. There is the Bodhisattva vow. So that incident resonates in my mind to this day. I don't fully grasp what was revealed to me. Of course, I had the presence of mind to ask him what I knew people would say, did you ask him? I said, do you know where you're going to come back? Because I knew somebody would blame me if I didn't, remembering Ananda's failure to ask the right question at the right time. Anyway, he said he didn't know, he didn't really think about it, but he thought, if it was to do with the law of averages, Vivekaratna will be pleased to know, it would possibly be either in India or China. Peter will be pleased to hear. He said it's probably not to do with the law of averages. Anyway, that incident really took my breath away, because very obvious that what Bhante did in the ceremony with Dada Rinpoche in 1962, bound his life, as it were. He saw it as having a determining effect on what would happen after his death. So in very deep waters indeed when we think about this. And at the time I reflected that this Bodhisattva vow that he took, this expression of the bodhicitta as he experienced it, must run extremely deep, and to the point that it went against, as it were, his more human desire for peace, to be out of it for a while. It ran against that, and it was almost sort of independent of him, it was bigger than him. And I reflected later on that, and been connecting a bit more with that today, what Bhante says about the Bodhisattva vow and about taking the vow with Dada Rinpoche. And thinking back, way back to the 1950s when he was in Kalimpong, and he wrote a survey of Buddhism, and in the survey of Buddhism, a good half of the survey is a paean to the Bodhisattva ideal. I know at Padmaloka you don't deal with that part of it, but he deals with it the most highly inspired poetic terms. The whole of the survey is a spiritual experience, if you see what I mean. It's more to do with an uplifting spiritual experience. Some of the exposition of the Dhamma is a bit dated, modern scholarships sees things rather differently, and so forth. But you don't read it for that. You read it for the deep, deep inspiration. And it's very clear when Bhante's talking about this, the Bodhisattva ideal, just how deeply he's inspired by it and how much it motivates him. And I know that he was reading particularly Shantideva in not particularly good translations at that time, but reading Shantideva, reading the Shiksha Samuchaya by Shantideva, which is a compendium of extracts from Buddhist texts by Shantideva illustrating the Bodhisattva path. So very, very strongly inspired by the Bodhisattva ideal, and at the same time he was exploring his own meditation experience, and in I think it's not it's facing Mount Kanchenjunga, I think, he talks about how he began to befriend Dr. Metta, otherwise known as God, the Parsi mystic, indeed, from Mumbai and also Pune, who did automatic writing. He believed he was in contact with higher spiritual forces and that they manifested through his pen. And Bhante says of that, I've talked to him about this person and he writes a bit about it too, that although he couldn't take Dr. Metta's inspiration seriously, in the sense that he didn't believe it was God talking through Dr. Metta, he did think that the idea of being in contact with a higher spiritual force was important. And he began to sort of long for that. And he was also very impressed by what Thomas Merton, the American Trappist mystic, wrote, who had some contact with Tibetan Buddhism, especially with Chetul Sangye Dorje, about the need for contact with a guru to put you in contact with higher dimension of reality. And so all of this was sort of playing in his mind, Dr. Mehta's influence and the survey, what he'd read in the survey, what he'd written in the survey, the influence of of Thomas Merton and so on. And it was about this time that he found himself, 1956, December 1956, he found himself in Nagpur on the day that Dr. Ambedkar's death, the news of his death, came through. Vivekaratna City. He heard that that Baba Saheb had died, and he was faced with the horror that this struck in people's hearts. A terrible, terrible desolation. Even now in Nagpur, 60 years later, on the 6th of December, if you talk about these events, people will be in tears. People who never met Dr. Ambedkar, people who are from a completely different generation. The idea of Dr. Ambedkar's death is still difficult for people to consider. Yes? You know, the 6th of December is a very powerful day to be in, especially in Nagpur. They just converted to Buddhism just 6 weeks before, under direct, immediate inspiration from Dr. Ambedkar. No other reason. They didn't know anything about Buddhism. They didn't know anything about anything. Most of them were illiterate. They knew very little even about Hinduism, although they were nominally Hindu. They had faith in Dr. Ambedkar, and in India, when people place faith in something, and especially people from that sort of strata of society, it's a very, very strong commitment. And they're not stupid. They may be ignorant, they may be uneducated, but they're not at all stupid. And they placed the faith in a man who was worthy of their faith. We'll see more about that tomorrow, and I hope we'll hear from Vivekaratna about that, because he can speak much more eloquently than I can. But they placed their faith in Dr. Ambedkar. They become Buddhists, and they really became Buddhists because of their faith in him. And he's gone. Just 6-7 weeks later, they've taken this huge step. It's an absolutely radical step outside the culture in which they were born, which contained them, against the whole of Indian society. They've taken that step on the strength of their faith in Dr. Ambedkar, and he's gone. So Bhante found himself, the eye of a storm, the calm centre of this huge emotional crisis, a gigantic crisis for hundreds of thousands of people, especially in Nagpur, because that's where it had happened, the conversion. And over the next 3 or 4 days, he just responded. He did what was needed. He gave many, many talks. He saw lots of people. He arranged a big condolence ceremony at Kastachand Park, which Vivekaratna and I will pass most days when we're in Nagpur. You see the place where Bhante stood, the only person who could speak. I'm not going to recount the whole story because you must have read about it. He slowly pulled everything together again. He gave people the confidence and the courage to keep going, realizing that though Dr. Ambedkar was dead, well, his spirit, his message lived on in them. And people have told me who were around at that time that without Bhante, they don't know what would have happened. And as some people have said to me, that they have heard that people at that time said that without Sangharakshita, Nagpur had been lost to Buddhism. People who just wouldn't have known what to do. They'd fallen back into the old ways. And Bhante himself, he just was there, the right man in the right place at the right time, for quite strange reasons in themselves. But afterwards, in reflecting on that, he wrote to his friend, you'll see this in that book, Dear Dinu, that has recently been published, a collection of letters that he wrote to another Parsi friend. You'll see he says there that his whole experience at that time was quite strange. He experienced himself as an impersonal force, and that he acted and spoke without thinking, without knowing what he was going to say. And that he acted, he said, as if he was in meditation. No premeditation, no reflection, no conceptualizing, just speaking. And what he spoke, you know, we see, was exactly what needed to be said. What he did was exactly what needed to be done. He said that when he left, even though he'd hardly slept for 4 days, he felt refreshed, as if he'd had a holiday, as it were. Not as if he'd done perhaps the most vital work of his entire life. And he spoke of, yes, feeling as if he was an impersonal force. Later, as I've already mentioned, he said it perhaps more apt to speak of that as more like a suprapersonal force working through him. As if he wasn't motivated by himself. His actions didn't emerge from a selfish motivation. They motivated from beyond self. That's what he's getting at. What drove him was not himself, and therefore it didn't seem personal. Impersonal, he said at that time, but later thought suprapersonal got at it better, because impersonal sort of suggests something mechanical or merely sort of automatic or natural in the lower sense. So something working itself out through him, which I trace right back through these processes that have been going on in the staying in Kalimpong, working for the good of Buddhism, writing the survey, connecting with the Bodhisattva ideal more and more deeply, connecting through Thomas Merton with the idea of surrendering to a master, connecting through Dr. Metta with the idea of surrendering to higher forces, as it were, on another plane. And these all coincided with this immediate, obvious need, which he had the resources to meet. And he just met them without question, without thought, without premeditation, without preparation. Just acted. So this to me is an indication of the nature of the bodhicitta. When the bodhicitta works in you, it doesn't seem to be you. Bhante's never described it as bodhicitta, because he doesn't do that sort of thing, if you see what I mean. He just describes what he experienced and how it felt to him. But I think it's difficult not to think of it as something like bodhicitta working in him. When you experience it working within you, it doesn't seem as if it's you that's working. It just happens through you, and it leads you to do the right thing, what's actually needed in the situation at that moment. And you simply act. It's very interesting that Bhante told me that he's never really planned in his whole life, and that he never had planned all the elements of what we now know of as Triratna. He said he just responded to the situation. He never saw the need for a grand plan. If something happened, he responded. The whole Triratna has emerged from that process of responding, from that dimension that comes from beyond his mere mortal egoic motivation. This is the way I understand it, and what he's hinted at himself. It's very interesting that this process that I've outlined it, which is my reading, not his, although he's said things that I'm fitting into a larger picture. He's indicated this process to me, but I'm sort of interpreting it in a larger framework. This process sort of took another step just 4 months later. That's December 56, Dr. Ambedkar died. All this took place. They went back to Kalimpong, and in March 57, he took initiation from Chetol Sangye Dorje. He took the Green Tara initiation from him, and from that moment on, has practiced visualization, practiced imaginative connection with Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in one form or another, whether formally or informally, and he told me that from that moment on, his whole spiritual life has been guided from that dimension. So, he took the initiation from Chetol Sangye Dorje, who he, in contact with him and through recommendation from friends, regarded as a man who was in contact with that dimension and could open it up for him. And he did the Green Tara practice for a number of years and continued to do it, I think, continuously, and maybe still does it, I don't know. He doesn't talk much about what he does these days. He took on other practices too. But what's going on? Why did he take that, and how does it connect with what had been going on before? The way I understand that is that through this visualization practice, through the initiation, he had a way of connecting with bodhicitta, with the mind of Bodhi, on a more systematic and regular basis. He had a way of relating to bodhicitta, which he could then begin to stabilize in his experience and, as it were, surrender his ordinary personality to it. This is the power of this sort of practice, which all of you, when you are ordained, and if you have been ordained, you're already doing it, you will have the access to. You will get initiated, if that's the right word, in parallel with your ordination, or part of your ordination is the giving of a mantra and the introduction to the imagination of a Buddha or Bodhisattva. And this is your way, will be your way of connecting with bodhicitta. And that connection with bodhicitta will connect with your own mind and raise your mind up to the level of that figure. That's what the visualization does. In doing the practice, you engage with a mind that is beyond your mind, that is beyond mind as you know it, and that thereby transforms your mind, you as you know yourself, so that you become more and more like that. And the practice that I do, the Manjushri Stuti Sadhana, the practice says, you attain the rank of Manjushri Jnanasattva through visualizing Manjushri, gaining his blessings, his wisdom and knowledge. You are raised up to his rank. Through your communication with him, through your connection with him, you come up to that level. It's the principle of communication, essentially. If you communicate with anybody, and if they have any greater degree of understanding, wisdom, experience than you, and you are open to them, you sort of come up a bit to their level. It's the principle of Kalyanamitrata. With anybody. With a friend who's simply, as it were, struggling along the path alongside you, well, they've got something that you haven't got. So when you interact with them, they sort of spark that off in you. And I've often talked about my experience of going to see Bhante with some knotty problem, you know, something to do with either my own Dhamma life, or my own so-called Dhamma life, or what's going on, or what I should be doing, or what other people are doing. And I go to him with some sort of problem. As soon as I step through the door, I forget what the problem was. Because he is the answer, if you sure to me. His level of awareness is such that that problem does not exist. And so simply by going to him in a reasonably receptive mood, I'm lifted beyond the problem. It just disappears. Because, well, in his dimension, it's not a problem. It's just a difficulty that might need sorting out, might need discussing. But it's not a problem. It's not something that need really detain one much. So on a bigger scale, that's what you're doing with the Bodhisattva, or the Buddha, if that's what you meditate upon. You're putting yourself in contact with this dynamic bodhicitta, this mind of enlightenment, and you're allowing that mind of enlightenment to influence you, to communicate with you. Yes, you're entering into communication, and you're lifted up, well, towards him or her. And it's bodhicitta. So it has all the qualities that we've talked about, this quality of non-selfhood, letting go of self, therefore of freedom from suffering, therefore of great bliss, of happiness, of wisdom, understanding, seeing things as they are, free from conceptualization and views and so forth, and of solidarity. It's all of that. And so you're putting yourself in contact with a mind that embodies all of that. And it strongly affects you, strongly transforms you. You're putting yourself in contact with the Bodhisattva ideal as, so to speak, embodied. Just for instance, with the Green Tara practice, which is a very, very beautiful practice, you actually imagine yourself to be Green Tara. And particularly striking, being a man, that you imagine yourself as a woman. And a very powerful practice. Very powerful. Just that. Just seeing yourself as a woman. A green woman. The woman is not really a woman, because Tara is neither a man nor a woman. Just as Manjushri is neither a woman nor a man, if you see what I mean. You're using the archetype of femininity as a way of approaching what this bodhicitta is, because the bodhicitta is beyond all your understandings of it, all the ways in which you approach it. So you imagine yourself as Tara, Green Tara. Where is she? She must be here somewhere. Yes, yeah. She is. You feel yourself to be sitting on a lotus. You feel your foot to come forward. You feel yourself holding the lotuses. If you can't see it, it's odd, because you see yourself as Tara, but you know, you sort of, how do I do that? Well, actually, you're sort of seeing yourself right now. You've got a body image, a mental image of yourself, which is why it's sometimes quite a shock when you look in the mirror, because you actually don't look quite like you think you do. But you've got a sort of mental image of yourself as Tara. But Tara is not a solid physical being, but a being of light. And you imagine from your heart streams of rainbow light issuing up through the crown of your head and passing way up into the zenith. And as they waft up into the sky, they form into offering goddesses. Young princesses, if you like. Very beautiful. They're sort of emerging almost like mermaids from the rainbow. Very, very beautiful image. And you can indulge all your greatest imagination, femininity, going up into the zenith and making offerings, the seven or eight offerings, puja bowls, to the eight great bodhisattvas, Manjushri, Avalokiteshvara, Vajrapani, and so on. And they then send down blessings, white light upon you into your heart, and that generates in your heart pure rainbow light which passes into all the realms of existence, liberating beings. So you have, in that image, you imagine yourself to embody bodhicitta. You imagine yourself in the bodhisattva activity. You imagine yourself doing what bodhisattvas do, which is liberating all beings. And for a while, to the extent that you can be successful, you dwell in that dimension. You dwell as the bodhisattva. You feel yourself to be engaging in the bodhisattva's activity. And you feel yourself to be in this wonderful mood of deep, deep reverence, which is so much a part of what bodhicitta is. There's a wonderful paper by Bhante recently called Reflections on the Gaurava Sutta. If you haven't read it, read it. If you have read it again, recognizing in this rather simple, almost sometimes simplistic way of writing, which is forced upon Bhante because he's dictating, he can't see what he's writing, this most profound understanding being communicated. Reverence, which the Buddha feels, he says in the Gaurava Sutta, because in doing that, he reveals something about the nature of his own mind. So Tara, in this practice, reveals through your reverence for the eight great bodhisattvas, reveals something about, extra, about the nature of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is itself reverential. It's not that you're sitting on top of the world looking down. You're always revering. You're always looking up. You're always admiring. You're always appreciating. That's of the essence of bodhicitta. So when you engage in this sort of practice, you're for a while dwelling in that dimension. Of course, Bhante, as we've seen, seems to have connected very deeply with bodhicitta, to the extent that I think it's difficult to say he wasn't motivated by it in Nagpur in 56. That's something of that kind was working through him. So for him, presumably the connection with Tara, with Green Tara in the practice, was to some extent a real connection with Green Tara. For us, it's not going to be quite like that very often. Often what we're going to be doing is doing our very best to cast our feeble imaginations as high as we can, so that they sort of give us a little glimpse, a little sparkle of something beyond. We're trying to get as high as we can. What we're visualizing is what's known as the Samaya Sattva, the oath-bound being. The being who is the manifestation of our commitment. We commit ourselves to trying to see the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva commits themselves implicitly to revealing themselves if we do that. So when we start doing this on the basis of our effective going for refuge, therefore our effective Bodhisattva commitment, our effective bodhicitta on that level, we produce from our mundane imaginations, using every art available to us, we produce at the very least a feeling that approximates as closely as we're capable of to the bodhicitta. So we try, through using the forms that are presented to us in the tradition, we try to raise our consciousness as high as we possibly can. And if we do that faithfully, at some point, and, you know, my experience, from time to time, we may not be able to stabilize it, something happens. Something happens that is more than we bargained for. We do something that produces an effect on another level. in the language of this kind of practice, that in independence upon the Samaya Sattva, the Jnana Sattva appears. The Jnana Sattva is the Bodhicitta, embodied, if you like. The Bodhicitta appears to us, as it were, through the form that we're visualizing. What this means is not that suddenly Tara disappears and, you know, from the parted curtain there appears somebody who said, I'm the real Tara. It's not like that. It's that suddenly you see what that figure really is, if you see what I mean. To the extent that I have any experience of this, that's the way it's appeared to me. I suddenly thought, oh, that's what I'm doing. It's like that. That's who this is. And one becomes aware of a consciousness that's other than one's own consciousness, that's far greater, far richer, well, everything that I've already talked about, that you are now in relationship with. And that at least for a little while, as long as you can sustain it, you are connected to, you're in communication with. And that profoundly alters your experience, at least for a while. And as I said, Bhante spoke of himself that from that point on, when he'd gained that initiation from Chetral Sangye Dorje, his whole Dhamma life was lived from that level, was guided from that dimension. For instance, he says that while he was writing The Three Jewels, which I think is one of his most spiritually demanding and rich works, it's at a higher level than the survey, believe it or not, spiritually speaking. While he was writing that, he would sometimes come across something he didn't understand, something that he didn't quite sort of grasp what really the tradition was saying, what the Buddha was saying. And at that time, he was doing the Manjushri Stuti Sadhana. And he said that he would do the sadhana, sort of taking the problem into the sadhana with him. And when he'd emerge from the sadhana, the problem was resolved. You don't have to think of, you know, hocus pocus or misty twisty. You can see that when you rise to another level, you can see the answer to the dilemmas, the problems. When you go into a deeper dimension of experience, well, experience becomes much plainer. That's what you're doing. You're trying through the visualization practice. It may not be visual. Some people just don't do visualization. But the imaginative practice, it may be even kinesthetic. You may feel the presence of something there, as it were. Or you may kind of sense that something's there. Which you can't see. Some people just don't do that very easily. Some people it's much more mysterious, the sense through which it's experienced. But yes, you sense, you imagine a being who embodies bodhicitta. He's a manifestation of the bodhicitta. And through doing that, you come closer and closer to connecting with the reality that is bodhicitta. You begin to get a glimpse of it. You begin to experience it. You begin to open yourself to it. It's an extremely important dimension of practice. And again, I think it's very important for us in our times. Not everybody gets on easily with it, but I think everybody needs to engage with it in some way or other. Maybe not through the ways in which we're given it necessarily, but there needs to be some connection with a bodhicitta as in some sense embodied, as being personed, if you like. I think it's a very important principle. Sometimes in reading, you know, a lot of the stuff that's about out there in modern Buddhist circles in the West, you see expositions of insight and so forth that are so dry, so cold almost, so impersonal, which are more psychological, and which don't give you a sense of something other. Insight should send shivers down your back. It should give you the sense that you're on holy ground, that something passes your understanding. I do not understand. That should be the feeling that you get, that understanding is confounded. Sometimes, and this is, of course, our great Western danger, it's increasingly a worldwide danger, is knowing too much, thinking that the intellect can grasp reality. As if dear old Kant had never lived. Surely by now we should know that the intellect is limited and can only reveal to us, really, the only thing it really reveals to us is mathematics. Anyway, that's another story. But the limitations of intellect in knowing reality are very, very profound. Or no, what's the word for it? They're very limited. The limitations are very limited. They're very immediate. And there should be a sense that you've gone beyond the intellect. It should be a struggle almost to communicate one's experience. It shouldn't be so easy. Indeed, far from being a sort of experience of a principle, probably the experience will be much more like experiencing a consciousness. Sangharakshita has a very good discussion of this in The Three Jewels, where he speaks about ways of talking about reality, and he says that that insofar as personality, consciousness, is the highest category known to us, if we think of enlightenment, of reality, as impersonal, as not personal, we think of it as subpersonal, if you see what I mean. So reality itself is like consciousness, like our experience of personhood, and more. More such that we can't understand it. It's a more that goes beyond us. I can say, do you see what I mean? Because I don't know what I mean. But it's that that reality is better expressed through the images of the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas than it is through impersonal principles. And of course, the impersonal principles do express reality. But because we experience those impersonal principles through the intellect, we leech them of their imaginative power. We bring them down to our intellectual level, which is pretty low. Indeed, our imaginations are far higher than our intellects. Important as intellect is, that's another story. So we need to find a way of connecting with reality in terms of our human capacity to communicate with personality, with other personality. But it must be a personality that goes beyond our normal conception of personality. And the idea of bodhicitta, as I've been trying to expound it to you over these days, takes us into that dimension. So when you engage in this sort of practice, when you engage in puja even, you're connecting with the truth, with reality, with what really is, in a more true way than when you merely think about it. You need to think about it, otherwise you start believing in God and things like that. You need the safeguards that intellect provides you, because otherwise you fall into wrong view. You need intellect to clear away wrong view so that you can imagine. You can imagine greatly. And the visualization practices that we do, the imagination practices that we do, are a very, very powerful way of connecting with bodhicitta. And that is connecting with enlightenment, connecting with reality. And you will connect with reality as dynamic, as transformative, and as acting upon you. So I've tried to communicate something of why this is so important. I hope this is intelligible, and I hope that in discussion tomorrow all the possible pitfalls and traps of what I've said will be guarded against. I'm sure they will be. But I want to say a little bit more about what on earth is going on. What are we doing when we imagine so greatly, when we raise our imaginations so high that they can touch upon reality itself? What's going on? What are these images that arise, these images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas? Well, brothers, I've no idea. That's the best way of answering that. Because if I'm to answer, what kind of explanation am I to give you? Well, I'm going to have to either give you a, as it were, physical or physiological explanation, which is, of course, what some people will readily do, something to do with, you know, chemicals released in the brain and so forth. Or I could give you a biological explanation. Or even I could give you an explanation, you know, which is to do with the mind as a sort of mechanism, maybe something to do with the cheese I ate last night or something like that. Not here, of course. You could perhaps explain it in terms of karma. In other words, which niyama am I going to explain things under? Because all explanation is, in the end, an explanation in terms of an etiology, in terms of a structure of conditionality. Otherwise, what is explanation? Explanation can only tell you, well, it happens like this because of that. But these images arise in accordance with Dhamma Niyama, which is a kind of conditionality that doesn't come under the headings that we know from the other niyamas. It's not physiological. It's not biological. It's not even psychological in the ordinary sense. It's not even karmic. It works in an entirely different way. It is a kind of conditionality. It does have laws. In a way, you're tapping into those laws when you engage in visualization practice. By raising the samayasattva, well, you are setting up the conditions which, under the Dhamma Niyama, may result in the arising of the Jnana Sattva. But how that works, what is an explanation? What kind of explanation can there be? Actually, what is explanation anyway? Famously, somebody said that scientific theory is a sophisticated statement of ignorance. All on any level, you're simply saying, well, that happened and then that happened. And actually, that happens again, that will happen again. So what actually is going on is really not within our normal realms of understanding. The imagination, in the sense of the higher imagination, does not obey the normal laws that we understand. It does obey laws. It has its own dynamic. In a way, this is what the Buddhist Tantra is exploring. The laws of the Dhamma Niyama. That's a thought. Just popped into my mind. Padmavajra will correct me tomorrow. But how it works, in a way, we don't really know. What we need to do is set up the conditions, and then the Dhamma Niyama processes will unfold. So these images unfold according to Dhamma Niyama kind of conditionality. So Tara, the real Tara, the Jnana Sattva Tara, is an image arising within the Dhamma Niyama. This is not my own original understanding. This is what Sangharakshita said to me. Bhante said to me that the Buddhists and Bodhisattvas, the imagined Buddhists and Bodhisattvas, are to be understood as arising in accordance with the Dhamma Niyama. So a different kind of conditionality, a different realm of experience, in which we have to suspend our attachment to explanation. Explanation especially belonging to the lower niyamas. Because all explanation is an attempt to make ourselves safe. Huh? That's why the intellect tries to provide an explanation of things, because through having that explanation, you come to some account of your own situation and of what you must do. So its explanation arises as a survival mechanism. It's got its value, of course, but this is a point where we have to suspend explanation and recognize we don't really know what's happening. But we do know, through a degree of faith, that if we make a certain sort of effort, a certain result may come. And these images that arise according to Dhamma Niyama processes can be, so to speak, brought into play by establishing a certain set of imaginative conditions in meditation practice. They can be brought about in other ways too. Puja is doing that. Sometimes, you know, when you do puja, something happens and you really are doing puja. You're not just sitting there, mandara, the blue lotus and jasmine, looking at your watch. You're actually in contact with something. Just sometimes. Maybe for some of you it happens a lot. For me, I'm afraid of a rather more, anyway, whatever. It's more of an effort, but Padmavajra is all the time. A faith, I'm not so much like that. My faith takes a different form. Strong, but not that form. But, yes, when you're doing puja, it's a practice in which you are trying to connect with the bodhicitta. After all, the sevenfold puja is, Shantideva says, a way of connecting with the bodhicitta, a way for the bodhicitta to arise. So you're setting up conditions, imaginative conditions, independence upon which Dhamma Niyama processes may be set in train. When? You don't know. You cannot absolutely determine them, because, well, the Dhamma Niyama is not yours to command. Bhante quotes, doesn't he, somewhere, it is a spirit that bloweth where it listeth, the good book. St. Paul, isn't it? You cannot command the Holy Spirit, St. Paul says. It's a spirit, so it bloweth where it listeth. It blows where it wants to blow. It doesn't follow our commands. So all you can do is put up the sail. The wind will blow when it wants to blow. But you can be pretty sure that if you keep on raising your sail, the wind will blow. So, we've got into some pretty deep water here today. I hope that nobody's drowned or floundered, or I hope that nobody thinks they've understood. It's extremely important. We're talking about the Bodhisattva ideal. And we're going to talk, I was going to say tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, very, very practically. We're going to come down to you, me, here, now, how you work to develop bodhicitta moment by moment, right now. So we're going to come right down to that. But unless you've got some grasp of the majesty and the sublime transcendent majesty of bodhicitta, you're going to practice here and now in such a narrow way that it'll be simply your own ego playing with itself, as it were, going round and round in circles. This is a terrible danger of Dhamma life, the terrible, terrible danger that in order to grow spiritually, you have to exert will. And will depends upon I. This notion of I, which is a construct. So you have to use the notion of I, which developed in the way that we've talked about as a survival mechanism and so forth, you have to use it in order to grow. But the problem is, in doing that, you're in danger of growing ego, of thinking you've got something, thinking you've attained something, thinking you've understood. That's a terrible danger. And it's a greater danger for us in the West, because we lack the facility for faith that, well, our Indian friends have, well, to a fault, to be frank, but they have it and I admire them greatly for it. They have a capacity to revere, which I find humbling. We've lost that. Not for bad reasons, actually, because we can see what false faith does. We've suffered from false faith, through, you know, the false faith, the results of false faith in religion and in a kind of politics that is a sort of religion. Fascism, communism and so forth, a kind of religion. And we've suffered from the false faith that they generate. So rightly we're suspicious. But in being suspicious, we mustn't lose the faculty of reverence, which it's very difficult for us to resurrect with our all-knowing intellect and our facility for knowing everything. Then you get fed up. There's nothing you can talk about that people don't know about already. Bloody Google, sorry. That was hyperbole for rhetorical reasons. So we need a way of approaching Dhamma life that gets us away from simply the inflation of our own ego, the endless refinement of our ego identity, principally through an intellect. Not without its glimpses, but those glimpses appropriated to an increasingly complex and facile ego identity. So we need this, and our whole structure in Triratna is based upon this principle. We do need the attack on ego identity through the more straightforward forms of Vipassana practice, but they need to be conducted in a context that is far vaster, and where there is a sense of something that is eternally transcendent, for which we have an endless reverence. And this is what you, in approaching ordination, and those of you who have been ordained, are wanting entry to. You're wanting entry to this realm of practice, which is extraordinarily powerful, extraordinarily moving, and deeply, deeply human, and that leads us into a capacity for deep, deep practice, a deep, humble practice. Because that's what's going to have to happen. The day after tomorrow, I'm going to teach you how to totally humiliate yourself. You're warned. If you turn up on Saturday, you've asked for it. We're going to learn how to completely humble ourselves. But we can humble ourselves because there's something so much greater than us that it's worth humbling ourselves for. So our whole exploration of practice of Bodhisattva ideal has to start with this opening up to bodhicitta as a living reality embodied in a form, in a personality, a person who we can come into connection with. And through that sort of practice, everything else will take its form, everything else will take its shape. I remember a very, very vivid experience of this myself. I practiced visualization for some time, but at a certain point, after I'd been ordained for about 7 years, I took up prostration practice. And I was doing the prostration practice with Padmasambhava as the image at the centre of the practice. And I remember the feeling of everything falling into place. I remember a dream that night. I can't actually remember what I dreamt, but I remember the content of the dream was everything now is where it should be. Everything has achieved its place. The mandala has a centre. The mandala needs a centre. Otherwise, you are the centre. And my goodness, God save us if we are the centre of everything. Miserable me. Not bad. Got my good points. But what a terrible, shallow, narrow universe. So we need this sense of the Bodhisattva as transcendent, and a sense of connection with that, of not just a sense, but an actual connection. And this is what you've asked to practice within. This is what you've asked to connect yourselves with. So, brothers, you want to do it?
Thank you.
The mandala needs a centre.
Endless reverence.
The transcendental majesty of the bodhicitta. Thank you very much. Thank you.